I think it was Murch who came up with the term sound designer. I think the story goes that they were doing the sort of work visas or something for Apocalypse Now, and he had to just come up with something in order to put on this form, and he just said, oh, put sound designer or something. It was literally off the top of his head. I mean, that's the story I've read anyway.
This episode of Sounds Good Right is a conversation with sound designer Pascal Wise.
Yo, T-Bone, did you produce this?
Sounds good, right?
I was talking to a friend yesterday about who's scoring something for Netflix, and he talked about this, and I've got to assume all the streamers have this. He talked about this, it's like sort of HAL or something. It's like this algorithm that everything goes through. And what the algorithm does is it analyzes the show. Basically, as the way he described it, it tells you what to get rid of. In a TV show, what that often tends to be is any stuff that doesn't really have dialogue in. So where the composer gets a chance to kind of emotionally set the scene or take us somewhere or inform us of something, long establishing shot, the algorithm just goes, nah. Because what the algorithm is saying is that's when people turn off or choose something else. What I find sad about that is the potential for it to kill off that. You know, you go back to the sort of 70s in the blockbuster, you know, they were putting films out and they just had no idea. It's like, did they have any real idea that Jaws was going to do what it did?
You know, the thing about a shark, he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes.
This idea that we have to know what we've got before we allow it out there is sort of a bit sad, isn't it? You're second guessing in a way that isn't very useful, or the AI is, I suppose.
Oh, then you hear that terrible high pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and despite all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces.
So I don't know if anyone's got an algorithm to suss out what's going on in podcasts. I worked in journalism for a long time, and I was a sub-editor at The Guardian, and I did some writing on music. That was all kind of freelance, but I had a nice, you know, and had some really nice opportunities. Did a column called We're Jamming, which was like, I think, pretty much the first multimedia column. I would interview a musician, but I'd also have a jam with them on the trombone, and you could hear, you know, a fairly basic recording of the jam.
He said, putting all these sounds together, aren't you afraid that you're going to get white noise? And I said, I'm sure it'll be noise, but I doubt whether it'll be white.
I did a gig with Alabama 3. I played with the Buzzcocks, Chaz and Dave, Matt Moss, Cold Cut, The Bad Plus. Oh, yeah, Roots Maneuver, that was a fun one. But there was one really good one. I went down to this studio in Waterloo. Amazing place under the arches. It had that classic studio smell that you've just walked into a mouldy loaf of bread, you know. And I was having a jam with Robin Hitchcock, who is an amazing guy. And I knew a very good friend of mine who's a singer-songwriter, was really passionate about Hitchcock and put me onto him. Anyway, I turned up and there were some other people there. It was like his, you know, there was a band. I wasn't sure whether there was going to be a band or it was just going to be him. Because we were underground, I had to kind of nip out to find out where the photographer had got to, because I didn't have any reception on my phone. And there was a really nice woman on the desk who kind of, you know, administered the bookings and everything. And I'd seen her once or twice before because we'd done a couple of jams down there. And she looked at me and went, well, you've lucked out, haven't you? I wasn't really quite sure what she was talking about. It's like, great, yeah, Robin Hitchcock, yeah, cool. And then she sort of quizzed me, sort of looked very quizzingly at me and sort of said, are you not quite sure who's in there with you, are you? And the honest truth was I wasn't. And I didn't know, you know. And basically it was REM, because that's who his touring band was principally made up of. while I was at The Guardian, I did have a brief spell of editing the food pages as part of the G2 supplement. Of course, it's important. All jobs like that are important, and the pages are important to the people who read them and all that. But I used to just get absolutely terrified every week and sort of frozen, really, with a kind of panic that was, I just don't have any idea what people should be interested in. I found that decision really, really hard. You know, is this interesting? Whereas if someone comes to me and says, right, we're doing a piece about food and spies, dream something up. And I'm like, yeah, fine. I love the job of doing the creative bit if someone else has decided this is going to run. I think that's one of the reasons why I find it everything so much more fluid when I collaborate and I'm working on something that is already going to go ahead, but it wants music or it wants sound. I feel it somehow it just shoves my ego off to one side, you know. You know, I played the violin. I had quite a kind of dry classical music education. The school, I mean, music at the school was, secondary school, appalling. I mean, literally, it was like design an album cover for Beethoven, do a crossword and try to remember what venereal diseases he might have had, you know. So I kind of stumbled through all that, got the A-level music, you know, where I went off to university. And basically, it was like a jaw-dropping moment. It was like, oh, my God, there was people walking around with these massive, like, orchestral manuscript papers going off for lessons and just, you know, finishing off their second symphonies and just incredible levels of talent and progress in music. And I kind of almost got scared off the idea of composing. So I sort of leapt into all of the really sociable stuff on the course. Unfortunately, it was a very sort of progressive course that you could really mold to what you wanted. And so I felt very sort of stiff as a musician, so I got really into improvising.
This next tune's called The Exorcism. We're thinking to invite a friend of mine called Pascal. He's going to come and blow a trombone solo on this tune. Please make some noise and welcome Pascal here.
And I pursued the trombone more, having done violin previously, and I did lots of contemporary stuff on the trombone and got... But I left sort of, and I actually then pursued a sort of music education angle and went to the Guildhall. But there was this thing ticking away that I somehow had not dealt with the thing that I really went there to do, because I almost got scared off it. Started doing a comic strip with a pal of mine for The Guardian, and we also started to do animation. Really my first attempts at putting sound and sound design and music to picture were my animations with him. So that was me finally getting around, playing catch up, trying to, you know, develop this thing that I wanted to do, which was basically, yeah, doing sound design and music for four things, you know. I love all those stories from people like Ben Burt, you know, sound designers like Ben Burt and Merch and all that lot. You know, where you'll read that the sound of Terminator 2 was actually dog food sliding out of a tin. I was always fascinated by that.
One thing you mentioned was Hitchhiker's Guide and Radiophonic Workshop. Were you a big sort of sci-fi sort of geek as a kid? Is that your world?
I know, the old cliche, radio has the best pictures and all that. It just seemed to evoke so brilliantly. And it was, I used to listen to it every night. I had these little speakers like screwed to the bedpost, tiny ones that were plugged into my Walkman. Every night I would basically fall asleep to an episode of it.
I don't know if this sounds a silly question, but what am I doing here?
Well, you know that. I just rescued it from the Earth.
And what has happened to the Earth?
It's been disintegrated.
Has it?
Yes. It just rolled away into space.
Look, I'm a bit upset about that.
Yes, I can understand.
I don't know how one would define radiophonics these days. I think it's definitely about the borders between music and sound and where you can be on that spectrum. And it's abstracted, you know, so you're listening to something that is somehow exists, you know, between those two worlds. It derives a lot from music concrète, or at least did originally. One of the reasons the sound of design of Star Wars, in my view, is so successful is that Ben Burtt was using real sounds and combining them and changing them. And I think the ear is really good at sensing the complexity of real sounds. It engages the ear in a way that synthesized sounds, I mean, this is probably getting less and less true because synthesized sounds can be so complicated, but, you know, I'll often sort of derive a drone from a recording of the ocean. And what I get just built in without me having to do anything is movement and granularity and change, you know, and I think the ear loves that. I think the ear is nourished by that.
Field recording. So talk to me about your love of space.
If someone says to you, you know, talk to me about some of your favourite sounds, I mean, you know, it's a paralysing question in some ways, but it's a good question. Like the other day I was thinking, I was trying to work out why I was such a massive fan of Pink Floyd when I was a teenager. One thing that I can say about albums such as Wish You Were Here, Dark Side of the Moon, and The Wall to a degree, take a band like Steely Dan, which is almost like the apex of, in some people's minds, of studio recording, right? That was like, you know, if you're going to make a studio album, like Steely Dan is kind of like almost some perverse extreme of that. And obviously Floyd were in studio as well, but what they always wanted to do is bring places into their songs. There was a sense of being somewhere other than the studio often in their tunes. The thing that always amazes me is if I take a very new, you know, a sound, it could be someone talking, it could be the sound of a door, whatever. As soon as I add reverb, without me sort of, you know, encouraging it, it just immediately becomes a more emotional experience because it's as if what's happening is a great kind of background storage of emotional responses is being accessed because things happen in spaces. Mostly what we hear is stuff that's bouncing off the surfaces around us, and that tells us where we are and what kind of place we are. You know, as soon as you put a voice in a church, you're accessing a whole bunch of emotions in someone about maybe what a church space means or some connection they might have to that space. There's famous stories of what it's like to go into an anechoic chamber, which is obviously a place where there literally isn't any reflected sound. And when John Cage went in, you know, he could just hear his system. He could hear his blood flow and his nervous system. And I know people who've been in that environment and literally they can't really take it for more than about 10 minutes. It's really oppressive. There's a lovely notion regarding the very earliest cave paintings that actually they have been deliberately done in spaces that sound a certain way. In combination with that, the use of flame to create a kind of shadow-based animation. So you combine that and you've basically got like an incredible early form of multimedia. And there's, you know, the stories about, you know, caves where in sort of ancestral history, it is thought that if you speak into that cave, you're actually communing with your ancestors. And that's because of the extraordinary sort of reverb.
Before I let you go, obviously you've had a long time, but I really want to talk about Cautionary Tales because you know that I am such a big fan. Can you just tell us what it's about and how it started and how your role in it developed?
A few years back, I did a show called Haunted, which was a forerunner to a hugely popular show on the BBC with Danny Robbins called Uncanny. And it was with a company called Panoply, and that company was sort of wobbling and then folded. But the exec I'd worked on that show went over to Pushkin Industries, another podcast company, and he'd really enjoyed the stuff I did on Haunted. And he said to me, you know, I'm talking to this guy, Tim Harford. We've got this idea. And he explained the idea, which is Tim has, who you may know from Radio 4, and he has a column in the FT as well. He's very much a sort of trusted voice. He fact checks the elections and does a show called More or Less about economics. But when he was a kid, he had this book, which was a sort of compendium of things going awfully wrong, basically disasters. And, you know, some kind of amusing and interesting and some genuinely horrific and tragic. And he loved this book. And he sort of carried that thought. He always wanted to do something with it. So the format is we take some awful, you know, either tragedy or something that's gone wrong, and then tell the story of that, but then also try and derive what lessons we can from it in terms of our behaviours. There's always a sort of psychological section where, you know, the captain, for instance, who piled an oil tanker into the rocks down near Cornwall, one of the biggest oil spills ever in the 70s, he was suffering from something called plan continuation bias. So we get a little section where, you know, that is explained. One of my first reference points was Hitchhiker's Guide. Now that I think about that, I think, well, what was the connection? But I think it was really that I wanted it to be, again, that weird term, radiophonic. You know, I wanted all its elements to be busy trading with each other. So if we're in the world of an oil tanker, I want the sound of that to inform the music. I want the thing to be flavored with the sounds. And because there's some dramatization in cautionary tales, that gives me something to go at. I'm making places. You know, one week you'll be doing Clive Sinclair and the Electric Car, and then it's the Charge of the Light Brigade. And then, you know, you're in sort of medieval battle territory, and then you're in space. And it's like, that's great, because it's like I start every fortnight with a blank slate. You know, the thing about podcasting it, as a musician, and you'll find this as well, as a musician and a sound designer, you don't often get the stage to yourself. I mean, you know, you've got to work hard to have your moments, you know, if you're horrifically ego-driven like me. So aside from the theme tune, which is obviously a really important stall-setting exercise, you know, and the theme tune to Cautionary Tales is very much kind of, I think I'd say it's probably a little bit influenced by Tales of the Unexpected, but it has this sort of, this kind of mechanical Victoriana and then a bit of a more filmic section. But it's definitely that sort of world of something sounding quite sweet and innocent to a degree, but also something's about to fall apart, you know. It's been an amazing experience. It's been a really, I've been able to sort of practice so many things in that. I just love to try and create a sort of an internal logic to it. And as I say, the radiophonic thing is just wanting the musical or the devices to be related to the worlds that we're talking about.
Thanks to Pascal Wise for speaking to me for this episode of Sounds Good Right. Check out his work. I recommend the podcast Cautionary Tales. Pascal talked about the episode involving an oil tanker crashing. That's a great one. I do recommend there's one about the Oscars debacle with La La Land and Moonlight. That's excellent. And a really great one about a building collapse in Kansas City Doesn't sound like that'd be great, but trust me, it is, for the sound design alone. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider saying thank you by writing us a review, giving us a like, wherever you get your podcasts. Helps people to find us. And also, if you're feeling really generous, then go to tbone.productions and get yourself some Sounds Good Right merch. It helps me to keep doing what I do. This episode was recorded, mixed and sound designed by me, Tom Wally. It featured additional music and sound design from Pascal himself. He was kind enough to donate me some music and some atmospheres from various things he's been involved in. So thank you again, Pascal. I'll see you next time.
Yo, T-Bone, did you produce this?
Sounds good, right?